From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and we begin this hour in the air, high above the Gulf of Mexico, where it's clear that oil that leaked from the damaged BP well is now dissipating. A Coast Guard flight over the area shows there's more of what's called oil sheen, but fewer of the thick black bands of oil that once marked the site. As NPR's Jamie Terabay reports, scientists want to know where the oil has gone now that it's left the surface.
The Homer Jet Center terminal is a revolving door of private planes and helicopters owned by petroleum companies. Every few minutes, someone is taking off. The U.S. Coast Guard took a group of journalists on one of its flyovers to look at the site of the oil spill. Tom Bowe is a maintenance technician with the Coast Guard.
There's some spots of sheen coming up on the right-hand side. This is Grand Isle area.
About an hour later and 100 miles from the mouth of the Mississippi, we come upon the oil rigs and supply vessels working where the Deepwater Horizon exploded and sank in April. Bowe notes the difference in the texture of the water from 1,200 feet in the air.
When I flew 2 weeks ago, there was more oil at that time. There were more streaks of oil, and there was more skimming operation going on.
2 months ago, I took a boat ride to this exact spot, and it was thick with black oil. The flight this week revealed a dramatic difference. The BP well's been capped for nearly 2 weeks now, so no new oil's been pouring into the water. Between the skimming, the surface burns, and chemical dispersants, more than 4,000 vessels working to stop it being repaired, the oil is dissipating. Scientists like Ed Overton have been tracking the oil.
We've been very busy, yes.
Overton, an environmental chemist at Louisiana State University, has been studying oil spills since 1977. Here's what he says is happening beneath the surface.
The last 100 days or so, the natural microorganisms that are out there that are part of the degradation system. When there's a big oil spill, there's lots of food, so they multiply and grow. When new fresh oil stopped going in the environment, all of this bacteria is still hungry. So I think the oil is still out there, but it's being degraded very quickly. A massive amount of it has already been degraded.
He says light oil dissolves quicker in the heat. The southern summer and the recent storm all helped. And what's left is eaten by the bacteria, which Overton says is then consumed by other organisms.
It gets eaten by these little critters. Those little critters turn into food for the big critters.
And then we eat the fish. Aren't we all ingesting oil in some form?
It's changed from oil into the life matter of the bacteria. And it's just like when we eat corn on the cob. You don't look like a corn cob.
But it's still unclear how much oil lies beneath the surface. Jane Lubchenco of the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration makes a point that the oil is not on the seabed, it's in the water column, and much of that is in microscopic droplets in dilute concentrations.
Dilute does not mean benign, and we continue to measure where it is and track it and try to understand its impact.
She says little of the oil on the surface is recoverable, so skimming operations have scaled back, but it's not over yet. Lubchenco says more than 600 miles of shoreline's been affected and expects strong winds in the coming days to wash even more oil on shore. Coming off the Coast Guard flight was pilot Lieutenant Commander Dan Lanigan. He says he's encouraged by the difference he's seen in the water.
I think we might actually go to the beach this weekend with the family, and I'm really happy to see how it's turning out, a lot better than it has been.
He might not, however, get to dip his toes in. Some of the beaches are still closed because of the oil. Jamie Terabay, NPR News, New Orleans.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. 18 states and the District of Columbia have passed through to the finals in the second round of the federal government's Race to the Top. The program is at the center of Education Secretary Arne Duncan's effort to spark innovation and competition among the nation's schools. To compete for a share of roughly $4 billion in award money, states must submit proposals outlining education reforms underway.
States must prove, among other things, that they're recruiting and evaluating quality teachers, fostering the growth of charter schools, and turning around failing schools. The program has had its share of critics, including vocal opposition from teachers' unions. Earlier today, I spoke with Secretary Duncan and asked if he's comfortable with Race to the Top being called a contest.
Well, I think what it really is it gives states an opportunity to demonstrate their courage, their commitment to reform, and ultimately their capacity to deliver great results. And what we've seen across the country, as you know, is this tremendous avalanche, this outpouring of remarkable progress. And the leadership is never going to come from us. It's always going to come at the local level. And I think what we've done is we're simply giving people the space and the opportunity to demonstrate their remarkable commitment to improving public education in this country.
Now, as you know, not all governors are comfortable with this process. Colorado Governor Democrat Bill Ritter said that the race to the top judging process is much like the Olympic Games, and he felt like they were American skaters facing a Soviet judge from the 1980s. Well, what do you say to governors who aren't comfortable with the process and aren't sure if they want to participate in the next round?
Well, we've had 46 states participate, so almost everybody has participated. If you go back to Governor Ritter, I think I've talked to him a lot. They not only participated, they're a finalist in this round. And I think he was maybe a little frustrated, a little upset that they didn't win the first round. And that's understandable, but it was a very, very fair and objective process, and they put the best foot forward in the second round. But what we've seen has been just amazing results. I think people tell you you've seen more reform in the past 18 months than you have maybe in the past decade in this country, and that's because of the leadership and the courage at the local level.
Was that part of the goals to not just hand out the money, but to jumpstart that conversation?
Oh, absolutely. This isn't about the money, but folks don't understand, while $4 billion sounds like a lot of money, race to the top, that $4 billion represents less than 1% of what our country spends on K-12 education every year. We spend $650 billion. So it's really not about the money. It's unleashed this creativity and innovation that's absolutely remarkable, and raising standards is an absolute game changer.
In the first round of Race to the Top, only two states came out winners, and that turned into a little bit of a headache for the department. You said that this round could produce 15 winners. How has the competitive criteria changed, and what did you learn from that first round?
It hasn't changed at all, and we anticipate probably having somewhere between 10 and 15 folks receiving money the second round. We had two phenomenal applications in the first round, but again, we've seen great progress between the first and second rounds, and that happened in part because we kept our powder dry. And people saw more than $3.4 billion still available in the second round. And the applications, as good as they were in the first round, were even better. And so by keeping a high bar, I think we let folks know how serious we were about this. And again, I've just been absolutely inspired by the level of commitment shown across the country.
Some of the states say they can't compete, or they don't feel like they can put the best foot forward because they just don't have the resources to do the paperwork and put together a 2,000, 3,000 page application. Are you concerned that in the end you might be rewarding states that are really good at grant writing as opposed to states that really have collected the best and the brightest ideas?
Yeah, we've considered that very, very closely, and that's why we interview all of the finalists, all of the winning teams. So I'm not interested at all in fancy PowerPoint presentations and good grant writers. What I am interested in is looking at the courage and the capacity and the commitment and the collaboration of the leadership teams in these states and their ability to deliver results. This is much less a competition between states and much more really checking states' capacity internally to deliver against their plans.
Let's talk for a minute about the unions and the teachers. Teachers groups seem to be turning against your administration, and individual teachers have told our reporters that they have never felt more vulnerable than they do right now. The president of the teachers' union, the National Education Association, said this at the group's annual convention earlier this month. Let's take a quick listen.
Today, our members face the most anti-educator, anti-union, anti-student environment that I have ever experienced. The unfounded attacks on our salaries, pensions, rights, credentials, schools, and students are out of control. And yes, our members are angry, and I'm angry too. We hope for a federal government that would create programs to help students in need. And what did we get? We got Race to the Top.
Why do you think he feels that way? Why is he so angry about the Race to the Top, and why is he so disappointed in the administration?
Well, actually, we worked very, very close together, and I have a great working relationship with Dennis Van Roelke at the NEA and Randy Weingarten at the AFT, and I think they're great visionary leaders with courage, And it's actually interesting. The two states that won in the first round were actually states with tremendous NEA participation, 100% support. The reality, though, is we're facing, as you know, extraordinarily tough budget times around the country. This is a very, very difficult time for education. And we have to rally the entire nation behind this effort. All of us have to work together, and that's what this is about.
Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, and I look forward to doing it again with you.
That's the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Cindy Lohman's son, Ryan, was a sergeant in the Army. A couple of weeks after he was killed in Afghanistan, she received documents concerning a $400,000 life insurance policy from Prudential. What she later learned about that policy is detailed in David Evans' expose in Bloomberg Markets magazine. Insurance companies make hundreds of millions of dollars in interest in life insurance policies after they've been paid out. They often keep the money in their uninsured corporate accounts and pay the policy beneficiaries far less than they could make by putting the money in the bank. Here to talk about this are Cindy Lohman and David Evans. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And Cindy Lohman, let's start with what happened after you got the worst news that a parent could possibly hear, the fat envelope that arrived in the mail. Your son was insured. You have a benefit of $400,000. What did you do?
We had actually received paperwork from the Army that asked us to select which option we wanted to choose with Prudential, either a monthly payment or a lump sum payment, and of course I selected the lump sum payment. Then we received this packet from Prudential that was the lump sum payment, only it was in a checkbook. I assumed that it was an account, and I put it aside.
I have a picture of just such a checkbook here that I've seen, and it says, it looks like a check. It's drawn on Prudential's Alliance account. It's payable through J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. You tried drawing a check on this account?
Yes, I did. Later, I went to a retail store. I attempted to purchase a mattress, of all things, and I was told that they couldn't accept the check because it couldn't be verified. The second time that I attempted to use the check was at Target this last May, and the exact same thing happened.
David Evans, what's going on here? What are these checks? Where was the money from this insurance policy, and why couldn't Cindy Lohman easily draw upon it?
Well, they're not actually checks. In the materials, you'll see checks in quotation marks. They're actually called drafts, and they represent IOUs from the insurance company. And rather than the insurance company having sent the money directly to the beneficiary in a check, they've kept the money in their corporate account, so they're continuing to earn a considerably higher rate of interest oftentimes than they're paying out. Right now, these accounts are paying 0.5%, where the corporate account is making 4 or 5%. So there's a big spread there, and this has actually turned the paying out of death benefits into a secret profit center for the life insurance industry, including Prudential.
Just to clarify, we're talking about earnings made on life insurance policies after the death of the insured person and after the beneficiaries have been informed that the proceeds now can go to them.
That's exactly right. Where people think this checkbook represents money that's left the life insurance company and come to them, in fact, the money remains at the life insurance company, earning profits for the life insurance company.
Now, let me ask the two of you this. If you were now to go back over that thick envelope you received from Prudential, would there have been some page somewhere which would have offered the choice to say, I just want a check, send me a check for the amount and disperse the insurance policy? Was it in there, Cindy?
Yes, it was in there. There was buried down in one of the comments, that if you wanted the account to be closed, to simply write the check and contact them. People who are under emotional stress do not make the wisest of choices. And in retrospect, that's something that I really encourage people to do. Read through that or have someone else read through it or go through a financial counselor. The problem is most people who are under duress just simply miss those fine details.
And Prudential, from the documents, would appear to be offering you a convenience. We'll set up the account
correct.
For you right here.
That's correct.
Next question, David Evans, is who in theory is regulating Prudential or MetLife in their operations, or who could be regulating Prudential in this case?
Well, the insurance companies are regulated by state insurance regulators. And what I discovered is they oftentimes don't understand these accounts. There's no requirement that the amount in these accounts be reported to state insurance regulators. And they're not really equipped to regulate banks. I mean, this is a bank-like operation, and they're in the business of regulating insurance. So we've discovered that there's more than $28 billion in a million accounts at more than 130 life insurance companies. So essentially, there's a quasi-banking system out there that is not subject to the same kind of regulation that banks are subject to. One thing I'd like to add, there are 4 million federal employees and their family members who are covered by the Federal Employees Group Life Insurance that's operated by MetLife. And the information that they get when a death claim is filed, their survivors are told by MetLife, and I'm reading from the form, "We will automatically open a money market account in your name and mail you the checkbook." They don't say that it's not going to be at a bank, and they don't say that it's not going to be FDIC insured. So this is an automatic process in the case of service members and federal employees and veterans, and the choice to simply get a check is absent.
Well, wait a minute. On the form that you're reading from, it doesn't also say, or we could issue a check to you right now and send it to you?
It does not say that.
In the case of servicemen and women and their accounts, what does the VA say about this, David?
Well, the VA told me that they've started looking at the way they handle these accounts. It was kind of an odd position that I was in as a journalist to be explaining to the career civil servant at the VA how the program that he administers actually operates. He told me that he thought the people at Prudential were really good guys and that they don't make any money from the Alliance account. I had to explain to him that they did.
But he did understand that the money remained with Prudential until the survivor made some affirmative step to claim it and get it away from them.
He did not understand that until I explained it to him.
He did not understand that?
No.
And did he understand that the money was not insured by the FDIC when it wherever it was at that point?
He was somewhat confused.
And he administered this program?
Yes.
We've been hearing from Cindy Lohman, whose son, Ryan, was a sergeant who died in Afghanistan. He had one of these insurance policies. And it's written about in David Evans' article in the September issue of Bloomberg Markets Magazine. The article is called "Duping the Families of Fallen Soldiers." David Evans and Cindy Lohman, thank you very much.
Nice to be
here. Thank you very much, sir.
And NPR asked both Prudential and MetLife for comment. Both companies insist they make it clear to beneficiaries that they can withdraw benefits easily and in full at any time. MetLife says while these accounts are not covered by the FDIC, something they say is explained in the materials given to customers. These accounts are fully guaranteed by the financial strength of MetLife, which in the company's words, has been delivering on its promises since 1868.
Prudential says the interest rate paid to beneficiaries has been comparable to other on-demand accounts, and they add, quote, "While we have had years where we have made a profit, we have also had years when we had losses because we assume the investment risk for the money in the Alliance account."
We also called the Department of Veterans Affairs, who gave us this statement. "The possibility that life insurance companies are profiting inappropriately from these service members' sacrifice is completely unacceptable. The VA is conducting a full investigation into the life insurance companies and their procedures in this program to ensure that survivors are fully protected and being treated fairly with the utmost care and respect."
The statement goes on to say that at the conclusion of the investigation, the VA will determine whether to continue the use of the Alliance Account Program and that it will be contacting current beneficiaries to remind them of their options under the program. You can find these statements in full, plus much more about this story, at our website, npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.